first time.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And this week, we're joined by a singer, songwriter and guitarist who launched himself onto the indie scene in the early noughties as a frontman of one of that era's most important and celebrated bands, who, aside from pausing while my guests released a series of great solo albums, are still around with us today, with a new album on the way, in fact. I'm pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is Bloc Party's Kelly Okereke. You just heard Helicopter from Bloc Party's debut album Silent Alarm, an album that arrived in 2004 and introduced a group seemingly fully formed, confident and riding a wave of huge popularity and critical acclaim. Over the next hour, we'll find out whether Kelly really did doorstep Steve Lamacq with a demo at the start of that journey, how his various solo projects have interwoven with the group's life, and why he's particularly angry on Bloc Party's upcoming new album. But I started by asking Kelly, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
Yeah, I think I've got kind of two answers. I guess the first time I was aware of music was probably singing in church, you know, with whatever the congregation. My family were kind of Roman Catholic, so every Sunday we'd go to church and we'd sing hymns. And that's the first time I can remember thinking of my own voice as an instrument. But in terms of, like, popular music, my parents weren't really very musical. They didn't really have very many records,
right?
In the house, they had some like Beatles records, Stevie Wonder, Bob Marley, but the main time we would listen to music was when we were driving to see like aunts and uncles in the other side of London, and
okay,
they'd have like tape recordings of kind of Motown, some kind of Afrobeat music, King Sunny Ade.
Yeah.
It was in a lot of my formative years, which is weird because, like, at the time, I really resisted it because it was the, the music of my parents. I wasn't really down, but it's funny to see how the music that they were into has kind of bled into where I'm at right now.
Did music feel special to you when you were a kid? I guess if you're hearing it in church, there's a certain sort of kind of a celebratory, like, this is a special thing. But did you kind of value music, or was it just something that was kind of around?
I mean, no, I didn't. I can't say it's something I really thought about until I was in my kind of late teens, you know.
Yeah.
Although I did sing in church, and that was the first time I guess I practically applied myself musically, I didn't, you know, I wasn't really thinking about becoming a singer. It was just, that was the first time, I guess, that I did regularly, I guess, commune with music was in church.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I was a teenager and, I guess, in bands that it started to take that kind of space for me.
Yeah. What was the first single you owned?
This is, like, super embarrassing, but...
it's good, because at least it's going to be honest. It's not going to be someone going, actually, it was Noi. It's like, no, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Come on, don't say that.
I mean, it's actually not the musical choice that's embarrassing, but the kind of the situation. But the first single that I bought was, I think it was, like, No Need to Argue by the Cranberries.
Okay.
It was the year that record was massive, but it was only embarrassing because I bought it for my sister, but then she, for her Christmas present, but she had bought me the entire album for my Christmas present. So, yeah, that was kind of embarrassing. But yeah, that was the first single that I bought that was played in the house. I mean, I didn't really buy singles for myself. They all seemed like a bit of a waste of money.
Yeah.
So I always kind of went straight into records.
What was the record then? What was the first album that really made an impression on you, do you think?
The first album that really made an impression on me was Dogman Star by Suede.
Oh, great record.
It came into my life quite in a kind of odd way because I'd seen a clip of their single Stay Together. I guess it kind of cast a spell on me, so I thought, I'm going to go and I'm going to buy this record and listen to this song. But I bought Dogman Star, and Stay Together wasn't on Dogman Star.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first few months, I was kind of disappointed because I wasn't sure if I just imagined this song. I didn't know what it was called, so I was super bummed out on my first few listens. But it started kind of weaving itself into me because I would listen to the record, like, every night, I guess, for, like, that whole summer, you know, towards the end of the year, and it was the first time that I'd really ever made myself listen to a record from start to finish.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Initially, I wasn't really into the record. It just sounded so vast, and all these weird kind of reverbs and clanging metallic guitars. It was just, I'd never heard anything like it. But, you know, slowly it just started to kind of embed itself in me, and I love it. I think it's such a kind of cinematic noir album, and also because you can really get the sense of, you know, Brett singing about London. Like, I could really feel, I don't know, just songs about people in taxis, and it took me somewhere. It was the first record I ever fell in love with that I wanted to know about the people that made it, and I wanted to know about how it came together and the artwork and everything. So there had been records before that I'd listened to, but yeah, that was the first one that I became obsessed with.
Yeah. What's the first gig that you went to then?
The Cranberries again. Wembley Arena. I've been probably about 14 or something.
Okay.
So I went with my best friend at school, his mum and my mum. And we went, like, you know, we got there really early and
yep.
you know, had sandwiches and kind of queued up and stuff and you know, and it was a fine show. I remember that Bernard Butler actually came out and performed Dreams with them.
Oh, wow. So when did you first start thinking about, well, maybe I could play some guitar, maybe I could sing, maybe this is something that I want to pursue in some form? Not like I want to be a star, but like maybe this is something that I might enjoy.
You know, during my teens, I always felt that pop music was the medium for me. It kind of, it excited me, you know, seeing acts on Top of the Pops and, you know I remember seeing Criss Cross. These rap kids
who wore their clothes backwards. I remember them. Strong look.
I remember being kind of blown away that they were so young and they're like my age and they looked like me, and I just thought that would be cool, that would be a cool thing to do. But you know, I didn't really take steps at that age, but that was probably the first point where I felt devoting my life to music, you know, could be cool, you know. I come stumble with something pumping to keep you jumping. R&B rapping war crap is what I'm dumping. But it wasn't until I was in my teens and in secondary school that I, you know, I started playing guitar. It wasn't until then that that it started to come together, this idea of being a musician.
Yeah. You know. Who did you want to be? You know, you're sort of 15 or 16, you're starting to learn an instrument, and you're like, there's always like, oh, I want to be Frank Black, or I want to be...
Sure. I don't know that I wanted to be anyone else. You know, I taught myself the basics of the guitar because my sister had a Spanish guitar in her room. And I remember the first cover I ever did was Stutter by Elastica.
Okay.
It was four chords. But beyond that, I didn't really ever try to emulate other guitarists. It was more about learning the instrument so I could write songs, my own songs. That was something I was very keen on very early on. It was about, I don't know, expressing myself. Maybe if I'd seen more people that looked like me playing instruments, I would have maybe gone down that path. But
right.
because I didn't, it was about trying to make my own world.
Thank you. What were your first impressions of Russell then, when you first met him?
I thought he was funny. I thought he was really funny. Yeah. He was where I kind of grew up in Essex. You know, there weren't very many kids that were into alternative music, kind of the kids in the area, those schools all kind of knew each other because they all wore baggy jeans or whatever and dyed their hair. So it was kind of quite a tight community because, you know, walking around Essex, you know, looking like that, you could get into trouble. It was kind of quite a laddie type place.
Okay.
So, you know, you were always hearing things about friends being bashed or whatever. So you know, there was a community. So I didn't go to school with Russell, but I met him at parties and we started speaking. And I just thought he was really funny and he could play like every single song that you asked him to play, he could play it on the guitar, and that kind of blew my mind that someone could do that. That someone would be so patient that they'd bother to work out all those kind of guitar parts. Yeah. So yeah, that was the first thing that I remember about Russell.
What was the first block party rehearsal like? Because it always splits into two camps when I speak to people about this. Either it's like, you know what, from the moment even though we weren't great, we knew there was something there. And the other half of the camp is like, we were rubbish for ages. I think both of which are obviously valid. Which side of the coin were you guys, do you think?
It was kind of a bit of both because, you know, we spent like years trying to find like a rhythm section. We spent probably about 2 years of playing with every drummer and bassist that we could find. By the time our drummer then, Matt, our first rehearsal with him was in a studio in West London called Graceland Studios. And, you know, we knew within seconds of him playing that he was bringing something magical to what we were doing. And I think we knew that there was something there, but we didn't know, you know, we didn't know where it was going to go, but we felt that all the pieces were there. And months after he joined, we started getting kind of interest, so it did kind of all come together.
To, you know, your early stuff before this, and like even from like She's Hearing Voices straight away, it felt pretty fully formed from that first release. It's kind of all the building blocks are there already straight from the off, aren't they?
I mean, it's interesting to hear how other people kind of see it. I think we knew by that point that we had a certain confidence about what it is that we could do as musicians.
Yeah.
I think we always kind of, you know, we spoke a lot about music, we shared a lot of music, we were all moved by a lot of the same records at the same time, so there was like a frame of reference that we all kind of understood. I think we kind of knew what we were doing at that point. But, you know, obviously the sound changed and developed kind of over the years. But I think, yeah, I think at the start we were confident in our abilities as musicians, for sure.
Is the Steve Lamacq story true? The story that you just sort of went up to him, gave him a demo, yeah, and that was it? Or is that just a really lovely myth?
I mean, I did go up to him. I did go up to him and give him a demo at like a Franz Ferdinand show at the ICA.
Oh, that's so nice.
So yeah, I did do that. But I remember reading that we got our big break because we'd supported Franz Ferdinand once, and then there was a story about kind of Steve Lamacq, and I think it was a combination of things.
Okay.
I think at that time I remember we were featured in The Face as well. I think it was just the cumulative effect of lots of people talking about you in different places that, mm-hmm, you know, makes a buzz start to happen. So we definitely owe Steve Lamacq a lot, for sure, because it was the first time we were played on the radio, so I don't want to take away from that.
Let's talk about Mogwai, who doesn't appreciate the sonic majesty of Mogwai. Where does that story begin with you then? When did you first hear them?
My introduction to Mogwai, again, is something that I put down to the people that I was kind of rolling with when I was at sixth form. I mean, I'd never heard of their music.
Anything like them before?
No, I mean, I didn't even know that you could listen to instrumental like music. Yeah, because... But, you know, and it sounds absurd now, you know, there was a lot of that music that I didn't vibe with. There was a lot of post-rock that I thought was really kind of sexless and dry and cerebral. There was a lot of that stuff that I wasn't down with. Mm. But Mogwai, I just always, just the passion always resonated with me. Like the romance and the violence in the purity of their sound,
yeah,
was just hypnotic for me. And I remember vividly just going to house parties in Essex and putting on The Young Team, which I think their second record or their first full record, and just the whole experience transporting me up somewhere else. So, you know, the track that I'd like to play is Ithaca from Ten Rapid, their collection of releases before the Young Team. But I keep coming back to this song because it was the first Mogwai song that I ever heard, and it's such a brilliant exercise in tension and release. And the second half, the outro of the song, is just so violent. It's just, I don't know, it stopped me in my tracks the first time I heard it.
That was Mogwai with Ithaca 27 Pi 9, the choice of my guest on the first time this week, Kelly Okereke. And we'll be back with more from Kelly, discussing Block Party's hiatus, his solo projects, and what the band have in store next. All coming up after the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio. Six Music.
And with the BBC News at 1:30, I'm David Harper. A senior Conservative has expressed concerns that asking pupils to wear masks all day in secondary schools in England could harm their mental health. The chair of the Education Select Committee, Robert Halfon, said the risks of COVID need to be balanced against the risks to children's well-being. The Cabinet Office Minister, Stephen Barclay, insisted the government was focused on keeping pupils safe.
Whilst 2/3 of adults have been boosted, obviously children have not. So that's why we've brought in some additional measures within schools. We're making available things like ventilators, an extra 7,000 ventilation units for those classrooms where it's difficult to ventilate. So we're working closely with teachers, with the teaching unions, with head teachers to ensure we can ensure that schools are prioritised.
Ministers have been told to prepare robust contingency plans for possible mass workplace absences. It's feared that the spread of the Omicron variant could lead to a significant number of public sector workers having to isolate. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
This morning, the government has said that the Prime Minister has told ministers to go away and to come up with contingency plans for some pretty significant absence levels over the next few weeks, as much as 25% is what the government wants a plan for. The criticism is that they're drawing up a plan now rather than already having significant plans in place to deal with it.
Police Scotland believe a fire at a coronavirus testing centre in Dumbarton was started deliberately. Officers say an item was thrown at a canopy, causing it to catch fire shortly after midnight yesterday. No one was injured and testing at the site has not been affected. The South African president has visited the Houses of Parliament in Cape Town following the fire which broke out in the building early this morning. Cyril Ramaphosa described the blaze as a terrible and devastating event just a day after the funeral of Archbishop Desmond Tutu in the city. Football supporters at this afternoon's match between Chelsea and Liverpool will be the first to take part in a safe standing trial in the Premier League and Championship. Five clubs are part of a pilot which could pave the way for an end to the ban introduced after the Hillsborough disaster that resulted in the deaths of almost 100 fans. The head of inspectorate for the Sports Ground Safety Authority, Ken Scott, says it'll be a far cry from the old terraces.
It's a kind of a modern safety-focused solution which addresses the desire of many fans who want to stand. So essentially it's people within existing seated areas who will have a rail in front and a rail behind so that when they are standing they aren't going to be subjected to any pressures from either front or from the rear.
And Lionel Messi is among four Paris Saint-Germain players who've tested positive for COVID after returning from the winter break. The PSG coach, Mauricio Pochettino, said Messi was still in Argentina and would not travel until he had tested negative. The coach said he was unable to put a date on Messi's return. PSG's first game of 2022 is set to be against Lyon next Saturday. At Six Music News, the next update is at 2:30.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Listen to Six Music anywhere on the BBC Sounds app.
Push.
Hello, this is the first time with me, Matt Everett. This is the show where we ask an influential musician about the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. And this week I'm talking to Bloc Party's Kelly Okereke, and that was his beautiful cover of Bronski Beat's Small Town Boy, released early this year on his brilliant solo album, The Waves Part 1. We'll talk more about Kelly's solo work in a minute, but let's go back to our conversation where I asked Kelly about how he dealt with the momentum that came with the huge success of their debut album, Silent Alarm.
The thing is, we were just, you know, making the record, we were just kind of petrified because... you know, we'd had She's in Voices and Banquet out, these kind of two singles, you know, and people were really kind of digging them, but we kept seeing this kind of 80s kind of throwback pastiche kind of narrative developing. And I think when we were making the record, we were super conscious that it needed to be wider than that. It needed to feel Technicolor. We didn't want to make just this cool thing. We wanted to put heart and soul into the music, and so yeah, like making the record, we were adamant that we wanted to for there to be like a breadth to it, but beyond that, we didn't really have any expectations. We didn't know, you know, some bands start this, they want to be the biggest band in the world, and like I get that, yeah. I get where that comes from, but that was never really our intention. You know, our intention was just to make something that between us we felt was good. We were kind of quite avidly consuming music at that point. We were aware of what the scene was and what the kind of landscape was, and I guess the scenes that we came from of art rock leaning indie music, we just wanted to make something that felt good rather than kind of cheesy or hollow. The kind of months after that, you hit America really hard, you worked hard over there, and like made an impact that most bands in that position you're in don't normally make. You, as I say, the momentum was pretty full on. Did you enjoy that? Did you navigate it quite well? Because it's draining, that stuff, if you're going to go out and quote unquote break the states. It always kind of, in the first few years, it always felt exciting. You know, I don't remember going to the states and feeling like I didn't want to be there.
Right.
You know, the shows always felt like they were getting bigger and the people were getting more kind of amped up, and it was an exciting time. It was only really kind of after the second record that you start to really observe the mechanics of how the machine works, and then that can be a bit kind of soul-destroying when you're... In order to get your song played on the radio, you have to go to dinner with the radio station and shake everyone's hand, and there's a real culture of that in the States that we just weren't really prepared for. So yeah, that was a kind of... I'm glad that we managed to navigate that and not completely like implode. But yeah, that was a bit of a weird time. But it feels like a blur now. It's such a blur.
I wanted to ask about, it's such a funny word, hiatus, isn't it? When, because you're like, have they split or are they just taking a break? If they were just taking a break, surely they'd just take a break. They wouldn't, because this was like 2009 and it was like people were kind of quite confused as to what had happened. Now there's some distance on it. Now, like, it's been a while and you can kind of obviously talk about it without fear of it being an unfolding thing at the moment. Hmm. What did cause that?
I mean, I feel like I look back on it as being a necessary part of my evolution as a musician.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted, during the making of Intimacy, our third album, it kind of became clear that I was having these ideas that weren't really kind of band ideas. And I think personally, we were at a place where we'd been working non-stop since 2004. Some of the members wanted a break, and I didn't really want to break up. I wanted to keep going, so I kept going. And was there a fear that we might not get back together? Yeah, I think that there was that was in the air, but right. Then but that's in the air every time we make a record. You know, we have no plans to get together after Alpha Games, but I don't know, the circumstances have to be right. You know, you have to be, because you know you're devoting so much of your life and your days to this kind of collective project, you kind of have to be in the right headspace to do it, or else everything becomes miserable. I mean, I don't really know how it was reported. I can't remember what the official line was, but we took a break, I made a record, and then yeah, I guess we got back together. Yeah, you're right, I completely forgot, because we didn't do anything for, and then we got back together in New York. So yeah, it was a break, I guess, but we got back together, and that's how it's been with all of our records. You know, you do it, you make the record, you promote it, and then you have to find the desire to do it again, because life will be telling you what to write about, and to, you know, this, you need inspiration, it needs to come from somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, and you did The Boxer, which is a great, you know, first solo record. It's such a good album. It's sort of chomping at the bit, that record, isn't it? You can feel that there's a lot of ideas that kind of come out at you.
Yeah,
It's a great collection of songs.
I mean, I think it was just exciting for me working with the studio, like in a very kind of solitary way, kind of seeing how far you could take things. It was just so liberating when you'd been used to all your creativity being mediated through other musicians. Yeah. It was nice to just be able to control everything and to really explore. And that was something that I've enjoyed, and I've continued enjoying, kind of making records by myself, because it just gives you an opportunity to take an idea to its logical conclusion. I love it.
Aphex Twin, which is kind of, I can draw a line between The Boxer and Aphex Twin, though. I think there's that one exists.
Sure. You know, as I said, I've talked a lot about the friends that I was kind of with when I was kind of discovering music in the 90s, and the one thing that I'm so thankful for about hanging with them is that although they had seemingly highbrow kind of musical taste, they were always willing to get down and go to raves, go to clubs, to immerse themselves in kind of dance culture. So I was able to experience two very different worlds, so kind of alternative music and kind of club worlds, and have them kind of running kind of parallel. And I guess kind of Selected Ambient Works was a record that was always put on if we were driving to like an illegal field rave or something, or if we were driving across town, or like the morning after when you're like, there's kind of those kind of ambient textures just kind of enveloped you, and it was like a hug or something, that record. That's what I think of when I think of Selected Ambient Works, the first one, and then the second one. They feel like sonic hugs.
When Matt and Gordon left the band, that was like 2013. 2015. You know, I mean, we do have to talk about, because it's like bands change, and that's just that's the way things are. You know, there's a lovely George Harrison interview, like in the 70s, when he's being interviewed on some American chat show, and he's got like his long hair and his beard, and it's like, you know, it's late 70s, and the interviewer's going like, "Oh, hey, but like it's so strange. You're not like, it's so different from Beatle George," and he's like, "That's the point of life, is to change. Like, I'm not the same person I was when I was 21. What's the point in that? That's what we're here for, is to do different things and move on and progress." And it's true. But still, when you change a band, you really change a band. It's not just, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, how?
Yeah.
What was the aftermath of that like? How was it to kind of put it back together again, do you think?
To be honest, I don't know. I mean, I don't think Matt and Gordon kind of no longer being part of the lineup. You know, there was never any question that we weren't going to continue. I'll just put that out there. you know, I mean, it was a shock, and we knew that we had to keep moving, and I think that's why we made Hymns, just Russell and I, because we needed to keep that kind of momentum going. You know, and as a record, it kind of did what it needed to do for me personally in terms of what I was singing about and how it came together. It still feels like a very personal record for me, and I'm glad that we got the opportunity to make it and like tour it and promote it and whatnot. But it was clear that the next thing we needed to do, it needed to feel like a band, and I feel very lucky that we were able to tour with Justin and Louise for, like, you know, for two cycles, I guess, for a Hymn cycle and for Silent Alarm shows that we kind of did. So we really got to experience their musicality as musicians, and I was blown away. I'm still blown away when, you know, when the four of us are in a room together. I think there's such energy and such precision there, certainly in how Louise plays, that I've never played, you know, I've never played with a drummer like Louise before. You know, we were all so adamant that we had to make a record. We had to make a record that captured the energy that we were feeling, because it felt exciting, and it was just so frustrating that the pandemic happened, because, you know, we were good to make the record at the start of 2020. That was when we were intending for it to kind of come out, so we've been sitting on our hands for quite a while. You know, luckily I made a record by myself in that time.
A beautiful record. We talked about it, didn't we, at the time?
It's a
beautiful piece of work. I love that album.
Well, watch this space, because there's more coming.
Oh, wait, part two, brilliant.
So yeah, I was able to feel like I was creative in that time, so when we did re-engage with Block Party, we were able to keep it where it was supposed to be, rather than take it somewhere else, you know, rather than, you know, because we're so restless, you know, I'm so restless, I get bored so easily, that the temptation when you're sitting on lots of music is to endlessly work on things and tweak things, and after a while, you know, that can obscure where it was supposed to go. So I feel very pleased that we didn't do that, that we had tunnel vision with this record.
Officially, kind of one song from Alpha Games, which is like a head down, like rocker, isn't it?
yeah.
I mean, is it indicative of the rest of the record, or was that just like, we're just going to come back and grab you by the throat just to let you know we're back? What was the...
Yeah, I think the latter. I think we knew that when we were kind of writing these songs, you know, in the Soundchecks when we were touring Silent Alarm in 2018 and 2019, we knew that this idea had something in it, and it should probably be the first thing that people hear. But in terms of the breadth of the record, I mean, it's hard for me to comment. That's why I was hoping that you've heard it, because to me it feels like it doesn't really feel like it's a step backwards. It feels like we're doing some things that we've never kind of done before, and that's what's exciting to me. But overall, it does feel like quite a dark record, lyrically and musically. But I'm curious as to what people will make of it.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the lyrics there. That's not something we've talked about a lot. You jump around. You touch upon different kind of lyrical ideas in every record. There's no one record that's just about one thing. So what were your preoccupations when you put Borrow to Paper then for Alpha Games?
For me, like it's always interesting looking back at records that you've made over the years, because they kind of are documents of the person that you were, the conversations that you were having, and everything that's kind of going on like around you. And I think with Alpha Games, there's no way that I'll ever be able to hear it and not think about the last 3 to 4 years in this country,
yep,
of what's been happening on a political kind of scale. Just, I don't know, I just, you know, I feel like we're in a very kind of morally bankrupt time. I've never felt so disillusioned with mainstream politics and what the people that are representing us. I don't know, I feel every single day, I mean, I'm getting like worked up just saying this now, and for the last 3 years since it started, the whole kind of Brexit negotiations, it felt like we were in an episode of House of Cards. It felt like there were so many behind the scenes machinations, and you know, it felt kind of frightening. And I don't know, I think that having that as a backdrop for the last 3 years has bled into what I wanted the record to say, you know, what I wanted the record to be about. And I wasn't thinking in a kind of political or a didactic kind of sense. I didn't want to be so literal. I thought it was important to talk about the effects, you know, how what we're seeing affects the personal and how people interact with each other on a day-to-day level, like, you know, what people say to each other when they're queuing for the bus, or if they're queuing in the street, those kind of interactions. Like, I wanted to explore the kind of the ugliness, really. I wanted to keep all of the ugliness in, of, you know, people that were so fixed on what it is they want to achieve that they stop recognizing like humanity in themselves, humanity in others, really. I think that's the central core of all the interactions on the record, this sense of conflict, you know, submission and domination. Still feel you're restless? Do you still feel like, you mentioned this, that like there's still, you find yourself being pushed towards, you know, new stuff, new solo album, The Waves Part Two, new sort of block party. There's still that desire to keep moving. For sure. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I never wanted to be like a singer, you know, like I didn't, you know, I said that I started singing in the choir like when I was a kid, but like, that was it. It wasn't until I started playing music with other people that I realised I had to sing because nobody else was going to do it. Like, I've always had that sense that if you want to get something done, you just have to do it. You have to find a way to learn to whatever, but you know, you have to do it. And I think that attitude is something that I've always felt when making records, is that you don't really know where you're going, but you're just compelled by something from within you to explore. And yeah, certainly in the last year with the pandemic and being at home during lockdown, what music started to mean for me became very different. It became a very kind of therapeutic experience. So, you know, I really separated it from the touring and the promotion and the kind of the showbiz. It was just about something spiritual for me. And I, you know, I think maybe it's turning 40 and knowing that I've been doing this for like half my life, but I think there is, yeah, I'm still excited. I'm still working out how to do things, how to use equipment. And it's a kick for me. It's a thrill.
What's the last song we should play? What should we go out on? It can be something of yours, it could be something of someone else's, it could be something brand new that you heard this morning or something you've loved your whole life. Where shall we end on? What's our final song going to be?
I think my final song that I would like to talk about is I Love You by Dizzy Rascal.
Okay, why that song? Why are we going to end with that?
Because he was probably the first, you know, I mean, I love that, you know, Boy in the Corner is such a brilliant record, and actually, like, his next two records are brilliant as well, but it was the first kind of, I guess, kind of black British voice that I think resonated with me as a, like, as a listener. Prior to that, I'd always kind of thought black British, you know, R&B or rap, I'd always thought it was a bit naff. It all seemed to be kind of aping like American culture, and it kind of always grossed me out. But there was something that I completely understood about Dizzy Rascal as soon as I heard that record. You know, he sings about, I don't know, growing up and getting older and, you know, life in, you know, Newham, and that was like the borough that I grew up in. Mm. So suddenly became very real for me what he was singing about, and you know, and I guess, you know, listening to that record in particular, it opened me up to exploring, I guess, rap music in a way that I hadn't really in my teens, being able to appreciate the lyrical energy and just the sound of the music. It was something that it was just a new way of hearing things, and it's something that I still take now with me. You know, I have to be honest these days, I'm more interested in rappers than I am like singers in bands or bands. You know, I'm more interested in what they do with the form and delivery as a musician. It's just more exciting to me, and I think this album is the start of that.
Yeah. Then that's the song we shall finish on. It's been good to speak to you. Thank you so much.
It's good to speak to you.
I love you, you, you. I love you, you, you. I love you, 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 you.
Where you say that's for? Some hot banger that you go, what for? Pregnant, what are you talking about before? 15, she's underage, that's raw. And against law, 5 years or more. That she wants a score and a half hour draw. That's the kind of threat that you can't ignore. That that you pinned down to the floor, but shut on foot, you said three magic words. When that's the one for the birds. When you said that, she forgot other ways. It's over, you better start buying the prayers. There was no intention of her being wife. Now she knows this, she's ending your life. It's a real shame you got hacked by the back. It's a shame that kid probably ain't yours. Yo, some bitch, no. She keep calling my phone. She don't leave me alone. She just moan and groan. She keep ringing me at home. These days I don't answer my phone.
That boy's some bitch, you know. All up in my hair. Thinks that I care. Keep following me here, following me there. These days I can't go nowhere.
Alright, she's a bad girl on the bus though. It's Captain Roscoe with a crossbow. She came, she got picked up, yo. Now that's what I love to get lost. Busy rascal come down like snow. With freezing cold flows like Moscow. Don't get me upset, guns blow. No, you're not ready for skid row. Bleak no, busy rascal deep roll. Big feet full of fools on my big toe. I got no chaps, no chain, not my soul. Get juice, but you don't get lost though. No slap, but you might get a cocoa. Yo, jambo.
That was Dizzy Rascal and I Love You, the final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Kelly Okereke. I'll be back next week at the same time with another first time, where my guest is going to be Nadine Shah. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.